So you should watch.
I'll call to order the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. Colleagues, today is February 6, 2012, and we are convened for the purposes of the organizational meeting to adopt the rules for our committee for this this abbreviated session. And then we will to give those of you in the room a roadmap of where we are going to go. We will do Senate Bills 1552, 1564 together, so you can testify on both if you're interested. We will not be moving forward Senate Bill 1576, so we will be taking that off the agenda. And we will then, later on in the hearing, circle back to Senate Bill 1589. And have a public hearing and discussion about that bill. Okay, that being said, do I need to open
we need rules.
Anything for the adoption of committee rules or just
yes,
take a motion?
Yes, you're going to take a motion.
All right, the first order of business will be the adoption of the committee rules. Senator George?
Mr. Chair, I move the rules, and I have them in front of me here, but the rules for the general government. General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection Committee for the 2012 session.
Senator George has moved the rules for the General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection Committee for the 2012 session be adopted. Is there any objection? Any discussion? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. I would like to also take a couple of moments for you all to introduce yourselves to the world and the rest of the committee. Why don't we start down on the far
right,
far right, or the far left?
Far left, depending on your perspective.
Right.
We're sponsoring bills together, so we're either on the right or the left.
Which one?
Senator Boquist.
I'm Senator Brian Boquist, 12th district, which is five rural counties in the center of the Willamette Valley, if you believe there's rural Willamette Valley. So.
Great, and I'm Senator Diane Rosenbaum, representing District 21, which is in two counties, Multnomah County and Clackamas County, and very excited to be back on the committee because I served on it in 2009, so it's great to be back.
My name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland, the soul of Portland, in Oregon State Center.
I'm Larry George. I represent portions of Washington, Clackamas, Yamhill, and Marion counties.
I'm State Senator Jackie Dingfelder. I represent the center of Portland, northeast, southeast Portland, and I'm the new member of the committee, and it's an honor and a pleasure to join this committee today.
Okay. All right, colleagues, I will then proceed to open a public hearing on Senate Bills 1552 and Senate Bills 1564. Jan, is there anything you want to tee up for us, or are we ready to go?
Would you like me to read a description of those bills?
Yes, please.
Senate Bill 1552 requires a beneficiary under a residential trust deed to send a notice of mediation and to enter into mediation with the homeowners for the purpose of agreeing to a foreclosure avoidance measure. It specifies the form and the content and the timelines for the notice of mediation. Directs the AG to specify by rule the identity of the mediator and to set the fee. And it specifies that the homeowner and the beneficiary shall share the cost of mediation, and the homeowner's portion can't exceed $200. It specifies the duties of the beneficiary when participating in mediation. It requires the beneficiary to record a certificate of compliance with the county before proceeding with the foreclosure. It allows a homeowner at risk of default to request the beneficiary enter into mediation, and increases from 120 days to 180 days. The amount of time between the notice of sale and the date of sale if the foreclosure is on a residential trust deed. Requires notice of postponement to be given to the homeowner if the trustee postpones the sale date. That's Senate Bill 1552. Senate Bill 1564 requires the beneficiary to determine if the homeowner qualifies for foreclosure avoidance measure, or if the homeowner has not complied with the agreed-upon terms of the foreclosure avoidance measure. And it requires the beneficiary to provide the homeowner a notice that explains determination before the foreclosure sale can occur. It requires the beneficiary to record an affidavit stating that the beneficiary complied with these requirements. and it requires a beneficiary to mail a copy of the notice and the affidavit to the Department of Justice. And it requires trustee to give the homeowner notice if the sale is postponed, and it provides that the violation of certain provisions are unlawful practices, enforceable under the unlawful trade practices law. Declares an emergency effective on passage. And committee members, you received written testimony from John Polanski, who was not able to attend the hearing on both of these bills.
All right, and just to also let the public know where we are in this process, we are still waiting for paperwork from the Legislative Fiscal Office and probably Revenue Office, so we will not be moving these bills today.
Senator Shields, there is no revenue impact on either of these bills, but we are waiting for the fiscal impacts.
Thank you, Jan. Okay, so why don't we go ahead and we bring up the elected officials that are here. They've got to get back to committee, and so we could we please bring up Lori Montes Anderson and Lee Berger and Senator Boquist.
Lee Byer.
Did I say Lee Berger? Lee Byer. Lee Berger's a different committee.
He's been called worse, I have a feeling.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Montes Anderson, and I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. And I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1552 and 1564. I want you to know what concern, grave concern, I have about this issue. It's having a tremendous impact on my constituents. Over the past few years, several constituents, my staff's wonderful in working with them, but they have virtually come to me with horror stories about botched mortgage modifications. Although each case is unique in its own right, they all share a common thread. They are telling a story of a system that simply is not working. And these people are hardworking, middle-class families, and they cannot get a fair shake or even a straight answer. The damage that this is doing to my community and my district's economy is not an exception. It is now the rule of our state. We've all seen the foreclosure crisis having a dramatic impact on all Oregonians, regardless of their party affiliations or zip codes, for that matter. The legislation before you today would go a long way toward finally plugging the heavy flow of foreclosures. We are definitely behind the curve here. Our legislative colleagues in the western states, most recently Washington, have already responded to this crisis. And standing by and doing nothing is clearly wrong. Our state was the only state in the West that saw a rise in foreclosures while our neighbors' foreclosures have gone down. By providing homeowners a chance to sit down with their bank and a neutral third party to foreclosures through Senate Bill 1552, we will be giving our constituents the opportunity to avoid preventable foreclosures by exploring alternatives with an actual decision maker at the bank. Similar programs are already in place in 21 other states. And Senate Bill 1564 would implement the use of the highly effective strategy known as common sense. By requiring a mortgage servicer to notify a homeowner of their mortgage modification status prior to foreclosure, we will be able to eliminate the dual track. One of my own constituents, Valerie Authors, went through this extremely confusing and difficult dual-track process. And as she was on the phone with one arm of her bank assuring her that she was on the path to a permanent modification, a FedEx worker was knocking on her door with foreclosure notices sent by another arm of her bank. In addition to ending the dual-track process, 1564 would require a servicer to inform a homeowner if their foreclosure date is postponed to a new date. Again, common sense. Public sentiment is definitely in favor of these changes. It is going to help the middle-class families across Oregon who, again, like I said, are struggling to keep a home over their heads. every loss of a home, of course, is a tragedy. Mm-hmm. But for a family to lose a home when it could have been saved through mediation or other means is worse than a tragedy. It is an injustice. Thank you for allowing me to testify on these two bills, and I hope you look on them favorably. Thank you.
And just to telegraph where we're going, I think we'll bring up someone from the DOJ next to talk about the mechanics of the bill after this panel, and then allow the opponents to come forward and tell their side. Okay, Senator Beyer, Senator Boquist.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Shields, members. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer. I have the pleasure of representing Central Linn and Lane counties in the Oregon Senate. As Senator Mona Anderson said, this is a serious problem and one that, unfortunately, the industry has not addressed very well in the last 5 years. The statistics in Oregon clearly outline what the problem is. One of every 11 Oregon homeowners are in foreclosure or behind on their payments. 54,000 foreclosures have occurred in the state since 2008. We know that foreclosures hurt more than those just unfortunate enough to be directly involved. Foreclosures affect every homeowner by dragging down everyone's home prices. And the backlog of foreclosures and threat of more is stalling out the home construction industry in Oregon as well as the nation. In the last 5 decades, the housing industry has led us out of every down business cycle and stimulated the economic recovery, but not this time. As we all know, the current economic collapse was caused by greed and bad practices within the larger finance community. Yet in the last 4 years, that industry, at least the larger banks, have done very little to solve the problem, and in fact, they've made it worse. This has been acknowledged editorially in the last month by three of the largest daily newspapers in Oregon. Those include the Oregonian, the Statesman Journal, and the Eugene Register Guard, as well as a number of the other papers have editorialized on it. As Senator Mona Anderson said, 21 states have adopted a form of foreclosure mediation programs, and they're working. In the West, these include Washington and Nevada, with Nevada being the newest and most aggressive. The research we looked at, and which I believe you have a copy of, the Nevada mediation program has operated since 2009 with significant success. According to Nevada, and this is who operates it in Nevada, is the Department of Justice or their equivalent, during fiscal year 2011, 51% of the mediations resulted in agreements between the lender and homeowner. Of those agreements, 60% allowed the homeowner to remain in the home. The remaining agreements let the homeowner vacate the home with an alternative foreclosure, including such things as short sale, deed in lieu, and cash for keys. Not always the best outcome from a homeowner's perspective, but better in the fact that they know what was going on, as opposed to what Senator Mona Anderson was just saying, where you had parallel tracks and you never know in the uncertainty. If you can imagine in your own lives, if you had that hanging over your head, what it would do to your family and you emotionally. Senate Bill 1552 and the companion bill, Mirror Bill, if you will, 1576, that Senator Boquist and I are chief sponsors on, is a very simple approach modeled after the Nevada program. It only asks lenders to sit down and talk to homeowners and explore other options before homeowners lose their home. Mediation is voluntary on the part of the homeowners, and it doesn't require lenders to do anything other than meet with the homeowner and see if there are any options available other than foreclosure before they head down that path. Actually, this is an approach that has been followed to date by most credit unions and community banks in our state who have more personal relationships with their lenders. And frankly, I know that, sitting on one of the largest community credit unions in the state, and they're very proud, as I've talked to others, are that they meet with their members and they try to resolve things in their members' benefit. Doesn't always work out, as is the case, as I mentioned, in Nevada, but it's the personal contact that I think makes a difference. Unfortunately, most mortgagees have had their loans traded a number of times, and frankly, they don't know who owns the loan or who's responsible for them, and often the owner of the paper is not the same person who's servicing it, which makes the problem more difficult. Senate Bill 1552 or Senate Bill 1576 addressed this problem in a very simple and practical manner. It puts in place a respectful process that really shouldn't need a law to make it happen at all. It's common sense, as Senator Mona Sanderson said. Unfortunately, that isn't the case, and most of our fellow citizens need to know that someone is on their side. Colleagues, we need to be on the homeowner's side. We need to make the system work. We need to get Oregon back on track and move forward. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Chair Shields. I'm Brian Boquist, State Senator, District 12, and as I said earlier, I represent the rural portions of five counties in the valley here, which bottom line is we're a little less economically advanced as the cities are in many cases that I surround in my district. And so foreclosures is pretty much a top subject from constituents, from community leaders, and as Senator Beyer pointed out that, you know, we've managed to fight our way out of every recession or depression in the past on the backs of housing, and we're not moving anyplace right now. Senator Beyer and I started talking about this a little bit at the end of the last session and then through the interim here, and as with all cases, and I'm quite familiar with lawyers, is we decided that we would submit parallel bills, which are virtually identical going in the process, and subjectly wise, I guess, intentionally wise coming out are identical, but one is this thick, one is that thick. And at that point, we decided that, okay, we'll take the cleanest one of the two we have and kind of go forward, and that's the one that we have a hearing open for right now. Senator Beyer and I are both chief co-sponsors on both of the bills. The one that we've been working is the one before us, 1552 right now. It's ironic that in the last week to 10 days that the Attorney General has reached a sort of an agreement with the top banks in which it outlines a framework if someone came to them in which they could then respond and attempt to negotiate something with their mortgage. So we have two chances that came up here, you know, not unknown, but parallel to each other, where we have a bill that says if you ask for a meeting, you can get a meeting, and we have an agreement with the Attorney General that says if you have a meeting, these are the sorts of things that they can offer and they're supposed to do. So we've actually kind of meshed them together right now in history. And so we're working 1552 and going forward. It's, as Senator Beyer said, a very simple bill. The one thing that's different between our bill, because information sometimes scarce, than the Washington and California bill is that those two bills in those states had bottoms in them. And as Senator Beyer pointed out, you know, there are community banks already doing the right thing. And what we don't know is what the bottom level is. And I know there's several members in the chamber that have proposed amendments of a bottom level. How do we hold the small banks that are already doing the right thing harmless in doing something here? And we don't know what that bottom level is. However, I have spoken to Senator Beyer, and I've actually got an inquiry into the Attorney General's office to figure out what is the bottom level? Where's that threshold where banks and community banks, like the one that Senator Beyer serves on the board of, you know, that are doing the right thing, what's that threshold? Is it 10 foreclosures, 15 foreclosures, 200 foreclosures? I don't know the answer. It's 250 in the other states, but I really get tired of it saying, well, California said this, and it's like, we're not California. So there is some individuals out there looking at what the bottom level is, and I've actually asked the housing folks that are running the federal program, again, what the bottom level is out there. So we have that information before us on Wednesday when we go forward. I do want to switch over to SB 1564 just shortly. And I signed on to that originally, too, and still quasi-supporting, but I'm always nervous of the UTP clause. If we can come up with an agreement in which we have a process for mediation in which they can go meet, and we have an element on the far side that says, oh, by the way, large banks, you've got to do certain things when you do meet, that's the ideal way to go forward as far as I'm concerned. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to entertain questions.
Any questions for this panel? Senator George.
colleagues, thank you very much for bringing the bill forward. I talked to Senator Boquist, and Senator Beyer talked to your staff, and I've drafted some amendments, and here's my concern. In working with a lot of community banks in my business, what we've seen since the financial crisis is that the regulations that are passed at the federal level and the state level apply to all banks. And what we're seeing is the small banks having a very, very, small banks and credit unions having a difficult time dealing with the regulatory burden that's being placed on them, even though they really haven't been the problem. In fact, I was looking at the Attorney General's statement from to this committee, and it says the DOJ has received just one foreclosure-related consumer complaint against a credit union since January 2008. One of the things I'm really concerned about here is that we continue to heap on regulations on small community banks and credit unions, and what we're doing, both at the federal level and the state level, is we're forcing those banks then to be bought up or folded into big banks that people seem to have the complaints with. And I really think that we ought to be encouraging people to move their money into community banks, move their money into credit unions, and instead what we're doing is heaping on regulations. So I'm going to propose some amendments that this set of criteria apply to the big banks that tend to be the ones that get all the complaints at the Attorney General's office. And I hope that you would review those and the committee would review those and see if we can kind of come to some compromise, because a regulation that applies to a large institution, they can deal with it within their huge financial resources, but small community banks and credit unions have a much more difficult time doing so. So I'll get all that to everybody as quickly as I can, and the amendments have been submitted.
Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Senator George, I don't disagree with you. I mean, even bringing this issue forward is somewhat unusual for me. I've always been historically a very big supporter of the lender community and know the role that plays not only in business but also in promoting home ownership. This is an unusual situation caused by, frankly, some very bad practices nationally that's caught a lot of money in the web. We've, as you said, my staff has been looking at that. We've been talking with the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs, is that right, DCBS Services, and with DOJ trying to find that bottom. We don't know what it is. Although I would contend that it probably doesn't make a difference with the small community banks and credit unions who are already doing this anyway. Because really, I mean, if you think about what are the bills asking people to do, and it's simply if you got a borrower in trouble, just sit down with them and talk with them. We throw a mediator in there, but frankly, if they're sitting down and talking with them to start with, they're not going to get in conflict with the regulation because they'll work that out before they ever have to get to that point. They will have already offered them, and that would have already happened. So it's I think it just encourages good, responsible, common sense practices. And most of the smaller banks and certainly the credit unions are doing that just because it's part of their culture. Unfortunately, some of the larger banks that in many cases are just acting as servicer for Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or somebody else, large conglomerate, it's more of a problem for them, and they just got to get their act together.
Thank you. Colleagues, I appreciate it. We're going to move on now. Thank you very much. Dr. Bates is also in the room. Dr. Bates, if you could come forward, and then I'd also like to have the representative from DOJ come forward for the next panel, and that is Mike Niemeyer. Dr. Bates, welcome to the committee.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, colleagues. I'm Senator Alan Bates. I'm from Southern Oregon, District 3, and I'm not going to speak to the bills very much because I think what I've heard in testimony you've already heard, and I'm not going to repeat myself or repeat what you've already heard this morning, take up your valuable time. I would, however, like to give a little perspective on what these bills could do for people in our community and what it means to the communities that are hard hit in this state. The two worst counties in Oregon right now as far as home foreclosures are Jackson County, my county, and Deschutes County. In fact, there was a report out you may not have seen about 6 months ago listing the top 150 cities in America that were expected to have the worst foreclosure rates. Number one was Bend, Oregon. Number two was Carlson, Nevada. And number three was Medford, Oregon. So we managed to make the top two out of three in the United States as far as what's happening in foreclosures in the housing market. And I want to tell you, it's devastating our community. 5 years ago, if you were in a situation and you heard about someone going through foreclosure, you would assume something devastating had happened to that family. It was rare, and it was kind of a shameful thing that would happen to a family, and hardly anyone could believe it. At that time, I don't think any of us even knew what a short sale was. That's changed in Medford. That's changed in Bend. Approximately 45% of home values are now gone, some places 50%. You can't go through a community in Medford without seeing foreclosure signs up and for sale signs up. When you talk to the people who have gone through this, it is unbelievable. These people are sitting in situations in which their mortgage values are now higher than the values of their homes, of course, being upside down. It's devastating families, causing divorces and separations, and very difficult for children. I see it every day in my medical practice, and the stress on these people is unbelievable. Even with jobs coming back, we're not resolving this issue. And the stories I hear from the banks are the ones you've already heard. People told to stop making payments, we'll work with you on this. People told to keep making payments, we'll work on this. And while that conversation is going on, they suddenly get a foreclosure notice a year later and are out of their house in 90 days. Happens over and over again. And I don't care what the bankers tell you, that's exactly what happens. And you're going to hear probably testimony saying that doesn't happen, but in fact it does. Calling banks up and saying, I'd like to work this out with you if I could, and getting the runaround trying to talk to anybody. Forget about mediation. Forget about notification. It doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. And you might hear all kinds of stories it does, but in fact, it doesn't happen. I will give credit to our local banks for doing a pretty good job. Rogue Valley Credit Union, as an example, not only talks to its people and tries to work with them, but has for the last 2 years put a seminar on about twice a month at night when they hire attorneys to come in and tell people what their rights are and try to work through these issues with them. I was frankly shocked last session when we couldn't get bills similar to this through this building. The situation has not improved. It's getting worse. It's time to act. I think we're going to hear a lot of stories about this doesn't work, it's not the right thing to do. I don't believe it. I do not believe it. It's time to act. I have friends in Las Vegas and friends in Reno I've talked to about these. And does it solve the problem completely? Certainly not. Most people, frankly, still end up losing their home. But at least they've had a hearing. They understand what's going on. They're less likely to make the same mistakes again. And they have an opportunity in many cases to actually hold on to their home. Admittedly, it doesn't happen a lot. So I'm not going to go on and on about this. I'm going to stop. You've all heard these stories. They are truly devastating to middle-class families. I believe this is the biggest thing destroying the middle class in America right now. And if this legislative assembly fails to act on these issues, I think we're all going to be held accountable for it in the future, and we should be. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bates. Mr. Niemeyer.
Senator Shields, committee members, for the record, my name is Mike Niemeyer. I'm the Alternative Dispute Resolution Coordinator at the Department of Justice, and in that role, I assist state agencies in designing mediation and arbitration programs. I was asked by Senator Beyer's office, and our department was asked by Senator Beyer's office to provide technical assistance in the design of this piece of legislation. I'm here to speak to the technical details of that, and in particular, the mediation program components of that. I'm not here to advocate for or against the bill. I'll give you a brief outline of the programmatic elements of this this bill, and then be happy to answer any questions that you might have. The program design gives to the Attorney General rulemaking ability to adjust the details of the notice requirements and the mediation sessions. The Attorney General also is charged with selecting a mediation services provider. This would be an entity that coordinates the program statewide. The Attorney General also sets a schedule of fees for the services in this mediation program and additional elements such as the training of the mediators and their qualifications. The mediation service provider would be required to enter into an agreement with the Attorney General, and this entity would coordinate the program, provide notices to the parties of the mediation, scheduled mediation sessions, also would be the one to monitor the grantor or the homeowner's participation. As was mentioned earlier, this is an opt-out. The homeowner would have the opportunity to choose to not participate in the program. And finally, the mediation service provider would send out a notice of compliance at the conclusion of the mediation. The mediators in this program aren't specified. They would have to meet certain training and qualifications as specified by the Attorney General. And finally, the bill sets up a foreclosure avoidance mediation fund, and into that fund would go the $100 surcharge on the recording of the notice of defaults, and also any public or private source of funds that would be available to go into that. The mediation process would be triggered when a beneficiary seeks to foreclose on a residential trust deed, and the grantor, the homeowner, would also have an opportunity to voluntarily seek to go into mediation before a notice of default is recorded. As I said, the fee schedule set by the Attorney General, that said, the fee to the grantor could not exceed $200. The conduct of the mediation sessions is essentially to be determined. The mediation outcomes would be a foreclosure avoidance measure agreed to. The beneficiary could agree to defer or forbear from collecting one or more payments, could modify or temporarily or permanently the payment terms, accept a deed in lieu of foreclosure, provide the grantor with other assistance, and the grantor could also agree to conduct a short sale. The I've done a little bit of research on programs in other states in working to establish the design of the program, and have also talked to some of the community mediation programs who might serve as the backbone of a statewide mediation program here. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you. As I made mention, and you heard my testimony, I mean, we're trying to get from DCBS or community housing or the AG's office some bottom, I keep calling them bottom figures, but you made mention just now that you'd looked at the programs in the other states, Washington, California, Nevada. I think they all have this minimum threshold of like 100, 200, 250 minimum foreclosures to fall into this set of rules. What is kind of the norm out there, and do you have any idea why they picked these numbers in these other states?
I don't know. As you're probably aware, this bill, for the purposes of the $100 surcharge fee, it's waived for institutions that have fewer than 250 foreclosures in the previous year. What's normal, I don't know, but I'd be happy to get back to you on that.
All right. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Brooks.
Because the only concern, you know, obviously I don't have a lot of concern because my name was all over the newspaper as one of the lone Republicans on board last time. And so... But the issue comes back to the same that Senator Beyer raised to a lesser degree, and that Senator George raised, and that a lot of other people have raised, is that we have a lot of good community banks, like Senator Bates said, and we don't want to hurt them because they're doing the right thing. We want to make sure whatever he does kind of holds them harmless and encourages them to do the right thing, but we just don't know in Oregon. California is a little bit larger than we are. Nevada, not a little bit larger, I guess a lot larger. Nevada, on the other side, has a different set of economic circumstances, and Washington's slightly different. And we just want to, that's the number we're trying to figure out. Is it perfect like it is? Is it more? Is it less? And as we all know, at least in my district, I don't think I've received a single complaint for a community bank or a local bank. I could name the 5 to 8 banks that I always get complaints on, but I won't. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate you coming to testify. Thank you, Dr. Bates.
I did have a question for Mr. Niemeyer. Mr. Niemeyer, I realize your job is being head of the Alternative Dispute Program, but did you come prepared also to talk about what the effect of the dual-track process that we're currently using in Oregon, that a lot of people have been complying with modification agreements and at the same time having a foreclosure proceeding, or is that outside of your area of expertise?
Chair Shields, Senator Rosenbaum, no, I'm not able to speak to that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Oh, Senator George.
If we could we have the AG's office perhaps put together for us how many actual complaints from community banks and from credit unions in the state, because I'm getting the impression that this is just not applicable to those folks. And I just, again, hate heaping on regulations onto people who are already being hammered by regulations that don't necessarily fit their size. So if we could just kind of get an idea of what kind of complaints, because if it's just one or two, like what Keith testified back in November, we really need to figure out a way not to heap regulations on top of people who are already strained.
Chair Shields, Senator George, happy to do that.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just clarify Senator George's question, are you asking about complaints that, where there is a violation of current law, because there's so little regulation in this area right now that there's no state agency that has a lot of jurisdiction, given that all of the protections we had were sunsetted and expired, and they were pretty limited anyway. Are you just asking for sort of general complaints in the mortgage area? Or?
Keith testified to us in November that there's like between 700 or 1,700, I don't remember exactly the number, of complaints about foreclosure to the AG's office. And then in his testimony, he says only one of those have been against a community credit union. And so what we're doing is that these small institutions, having another layer of sort of regulatory burden, it puts a much bigger burden on them than, say, a huge bank. And so the idea is that if it's a problem, then they can be included. If it's not a problem, it seems like to me that what we're really trying to do is solve a problem with a few 5 or 8 major national and international institutions to make sure that they treat our people fairly. So, I mean, that's what I'm trying to get at. What I hate is that I see a trend where we keep trying to solve problems that these few 5 to 8 banks create, and what we're really doing is shutting down small institutions, and they're being sold to the 5 or 8 banks. It just kind of seems counterproductive.
We're going to have to move on.
Okay.
Could you just get me the complaint information to DOJ on the banks?
Yes.
And who's been the complaints been against? Thank you. All right. Can we now bring up? We're going to bring up Paula Cosgrove and Cleve Abbey, and then we were going to bring up people who have come quite a distance, Elizabeth Peterson and, let's see, Elizabeth, I can't read your handwriting, but if you came from over 100 miles away, thank you. Same one. Okay, right. Good.
Mr. Chairman, could I also ask House Goggins to join?
Absolutely, yes.
Thank you. Testimony is being passed out to you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Bankers Association, the Independent Community Banks of Oregon, and the Oregon Financial Services Association. And it's 3 pages of bullet points categorized in 2 different areas. First of all, general concerns about the 3 bills. I didn't know that we were only going to have a hearing on 2, so I apologize that comments also address the 3rd bill in some cases. And then some specific concerns. I'm going to spend most of the time the chair gives me to talk about the general concerns, but I'd like to highlight that the couple of pages of specific concerns are actually quite important in terms of some technical problems, even if you support the policy that these bills have. I'd like to start with lenders, obviously, I think it needs to be said over and over again, do not want their borrowers in default. It doesn't do them any good. It costs money in the whole system. It's a tragedy from every perspective. And we have worked very hard with folks since 2008, and in particular in 2008 in adopting consensus legislation to try to get borrowers who are in trouble, who often don't know how to deal with those troubled economic situations, to talk to their lenders and try to work out solutions. As you may recall, those of you who are here, in 2008, we proposed a bill to have a new notice, which people commonly call the danger notice, written in plain language to go out with every foreclosure packet to tell people, this is serious, we need to talk to you, contact us, here are the resources for housing counseling, here are the resources for legal aid and other services. We need to get together and talk. So that is something in which we all agree. Discussion with borrowers and lenders is important. In fact, the the bottom line that I would point out is I don't think mediation is actually the concern. It's meeting and discussing is the concern, and I think that's consistent with what Senator Beyer just told you a few minutes ago. The other thing we'd like to point out is some of the programs that are most often highlighted, and Nevada is one of them, and Washington, a newer program, is another, frankly don't do as well as we do in our current situation. And I'd like to show you the data in the middle of that page. One of the largest residential mortgage lenders in both Nevada and Oregon, in Nevada, 47% of their delinquent loans end up in foreclosure sales, but in Oregon, it's a smaller percentage, only 38%. And that reflects that sometimes a one-size-fits-all kind of program like Nevada and Washington have don't work as well as one that is more flexible. Secondly, although we are still having many foreclosures, I'd like to point out, as my first bullet does, that the foreclosure and default situation in Oregon is getting somewhat better, and it's not 1 out of 11. It's more like 1 out of 20, and that's national data based on the third quarter of last year. Not good, but we are getting better. We're making progress, and that's helpful. The other thing is, how the discussion and our mediation is really not so much the issue as whether there's a solution found and does that solution then work. And data from the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency for the biggest institutions, which represent about 60% of all mortgage loans, and this is specific to the states, this is third quarter of 2011, shows that in Oregon, about 13.3% of loans that have been modified are again delinquent in 6 months, whereas the rate for Nevada is a bit higher, 15.6%, and the Washington rate is even higher than that. And finally, some Nevada data from the Realtors Association, which did a survey of 500 people involved in foreclosure issues in Nevada, found that only 3% of the eligible people used and were satisfied and helped by the Nevada mediation program. So we're all looking for solutions. What I would suggest to you that some of the solutions used in other states, in particular in Nevada, are not likely to be better than what we have and might very well be worse. The other thing I would like to highlight is this is a fast-changing area of the law. In the last 2 weeks, all lenders in Oregon, and those are big ones and small ones, and even private parties, have been subjected to a set of new rules issued by the Attorney General without any public hearings, that immediately, on an emergency basis, imposed on them all of the detailed requirements and processes contained in Fannie Mae guidelines for handling loans in default. The interesting thing, my testimony points out the Fannie Mae guidelines are 94 pages long. The problem is the rules cite that to follow guidelines of a federal agency that doesn't have any guidelines. We think the Attorney General meant to say Fannie Mae. He sent another agency. But assuming that he really meant Fannie Mae, those are 94 pages long, and they are very detailed, and they deal with all of these issues. We would like to have, as soon as we can, clarify which guidelines we're supposed to follow from the Attorney General's office, which is yet an issue that's not yet clarified. I think it's important to make sure that whatever this body does is either consistent with those or supplants those. And those guidelines, I should point out at the top of page 2, are overhauled about every 2 months. Since September, when they were reissued, and they're usually issued annually, there have been two modifications issued by Fannie Mae, another 39 pages of guidelines, and they all deal with the same issues that these bills do. The second thing is, and you've heard a lot about big versus small, the Attorney General just last week has announced that he and a number of other Attorney Generals have entered into a multi-state settlement with the five largest mortgage servicers. And his office testified back in November, as Senator George pointed out, that the vast majority of complaints his office received since 2008 deal with these five lenders. We don't know what's in that settlement because we haven't seen it. But the Attorney General's office does know, and he said to the media, and I hope accurately, that they include 42 pages of new rules for mortgage servicers, including these issues that these bills deal with. Again, at the very least, we need to figure out if we're consistent with these proposals, with these new requirements that the Attorney General is imposing on the five big banks. And then lastly, on terms of the general concerns, it's been mentioned before that smaller lenders like community banks and credit unions have not been responsible for many of the foreclosure concerns raised in Oregon. Many community banks, frankly, have stopped residential lending altogether in Oregon. I have been in meetings with members of this body where I've heard local community bankers saying, we got out of this business because it's too complicated and too regulated. We're not going to go back in until we can find that there's a clear, stable path so we know what kinds of loans we can make and what kinds of enforcement we can do should those loans go bad. These additional regulations are tremendously difficult for small lenders to deal with, whether they be banks or credit unions. I would like to just mention on the specifics concerns a couple of things. I am familiar with the Portland State Consensus Mediation Program. I'm less familiar with the one run through University of Oregon in Eugene, but I can tell you it is a very expensive process, having been involved in it through an unrelated kind of mediation through Portland State. Without, like Washington has at least, a limitation on how much the mediator can be paid, this does not, although it's supposed to be set by the Attorney General. This could be a very expensive process, both for lenders and, of course, for borrowers who would be required to bring at least up to $200 to the mediation. And that's one of the things, by the way, that we think has dissuaded a number of lenders and borrowers in other states from going into these mandatory programs, is they're told at the beginning, you can come and meet with somebody, but you're going to have to pay $200. In fact, we're willing to meet with our borrowers for free if we can come and have them meet with us, although there wouldn't be a mediator in that particular circumstance. And then the other thing I would just like to mention is there are whole lots of rulemaking provisions in Senate Bill 1552 and some of the other bills as well. And those rulemaking proceedings, unless they're going to be done on an emergency basis without public hearings, as we last found from the Attorney General's office, will mean that emergency clauses in these bills are just impossible. We can't comply with regulations in a process that hasn't been established. And all of us need to have time in order to implement the procedures necessary to do that. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's continue on. Whoever would like to go next.
Senator Shields, my name is Cleve Abbey. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association. I work for the Fidelity National Title Group of title insurers and related companies. The main reason I'm here is because I think the bill actually makes the mediation process part of the foreclosure process, as opposed to a mediation process that might begin with delinquency that Paul talked about, and if it fails, then the foreclosure is started and the foreclosure process moves forward. Because the mediation is tied to the foreclosure, it does complicate and lengthen the foreclosure process. The previous speakers all have acknowledged that there are a large number of delinquencies and foreclosure, as yet unforeclosed but delinquent properties in Oregon. And I think it's well recognized that in general for residential properties that are in delinquency, they are not well maintained, that their owners do not support the homeowners associations for the neighborhoods, and that these and other factors cause neighborhoods to suffer and property values to decline. As the state's economy suffers because, while these properties are in delinquency, the state suffers because the properties are not generating mortgage payments, or the owners aren't. There are no rents being generated, and fewer property transactions. To minimize these bad effects, Oregon's foreclosure laws can benefit the state citizens if they help move properties back into the stream of commerce as fairly and as efficiently as possible. For many of the properties, as the previous speakers have noted, loan modifications are out of reach. There is simply too much secured debt, or there are too many secured creditors, or the borrowers have no interest in modifications because they seek to relocate for job opportunities and other reasons. For those properties, making the foreclosure process more complicated or longer has a direct adverse effect on the borrowers and on their communities, because the borrowers are not free of their loan obligations until the foreclosures are completed, and their communities suffer until the properties are resold after foreclosure. The two bills that we're discussing, as I noted, make foreclosure more complicated, less certain, more expensive, and longer. One effect of this will be to stretch out and increase the burdens on communities and on the state's economy. Another will be to push foreclosures into the judicial process. This will increase court costs, a cost borne by all of Oregon's taxpayers, and it will add legal expenses and carrying costs that in the end will depress property values even more. And for those reasons, Oregon Land Title Association opposes these bills. A few specific comments on Senate Bill 1552. This will complicate the process by making mediation obligatory and conditioning foreclosure on a certification of compliance. It will lengthen the minimum notice period from 120 days to 180 days. It will require that notices of postponement be personally served on borrowers and junior lien holders. This is will be practically and financially burdensome and will discourage postponements. Currently, postponements are simply announced at the time and place for the foreclosure sale. The other bill, Senate Bill 1564, will complicate residential nonjudicial foreclosures by changing the definition of a residential trust deed in a way that makes this more problematical. It will complicate the foreclosures by requiring that notices of postponement be personally served on borrowers and junior lien holders like SB 1552, and by requiring personal service of the notice regarding a determination that a borrower is not eligible for a foreclosure avoidance measure or has not complied with the agreement for a foreclosure avoidance measure. And then finally, it will make nonjudicial foreclosures more of a, or the foreclosure avoidance component under the bill by subjecting the parties or the lenders to unfair trade practices. That will also complicate the nonjudicial foreclosure process that does not appear to have a bearing on the judicial foreclosure process. Which is why I made my point that I think this bill could have the effect of pushing lenders into the judicial process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And colleagues, is we're going to have Hal testify, and then if you could try to be very judicious in whatever questions we ask, if there's, you can get the information offline, that would be helpful. I want to make sure that everybody who came here to tell their story has a chance to do so. Hal.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley Watto Witt. We are counsel to the Northwest Credit Union Association. I'm appearing this morning on their behalf, and we represent numerous credit unions throughout the Northwest. I will try to be brief this morning. I will make some general comments related to general issues that I think it's important for the committee and the body overall to keep in mind in going forward with these bills and others that are like them. I'm grateful for Senator George's comments about heaping regulation and regulatory costs on lenders, and the new regulations that the Attorney General issued Friday before last is a good example of that. And I think it's important for the legislature to keep in mind that this is a difficult issue, it's a complicated issue, and while it's important to act where we can to improve things, it's also important to be careful that we don't make things worse. And I spent a good chunk of last week helping our clients understand their compliance requirements under these new Washington, or under the new Attorney General regulations. And I can tell you that I believe it is likely that there will be a number of lenders that will simply stop lending as a result of those regulations, because it imposes huge new costs in the process, and certainly in the economic environment we're in, a lot of lenders simply can't afford to bear those costs and still make loans economically. I think it's important to evaluate whether legislation like this does the same thing. It is the policy and the practice of credit unions in general to work with borrowers as much as possible, to try and contact their borrowers, to talk to their borrowers, to see if something can be worked out before they get to a foreclosure. No one, the lender, the borrower, no one wants the foreclosure to happen. Everyone loses in that circumstance. And so credit unions do everything that they can to try and avoid that. And credit unions are certainly not opposed to legislation that would simply put the same standards on everybody for those same kind of contacts. With respect to these specific bills, there are some issues that would need to be addressed in order to make them, in order to keep them from doing more harm than good. One thing I'd like to address is the issue of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. I'm not sure whether the goal of the UTPA provisions in some of these bills is to give the Attorney General jurisdiction to enforce these provisions, or whether it's to simply add the ability for borrowers to get punitive damages for what is otherwise a simple breach of contract. But I do think it's a problem, and it is one of those heaping on of additional costs and requirements that when you make these things a violation of the UTPA, you are inciting consumer attorneys to go out there and drum up violations for the purpose of seeking punitive damages, as opposed to the regular damages and attorney's fees that most borrowers would already be entitled to do. If the goal is to give the Attorney General jurisdiction to enforce these provisions, I think that the more straightforward way to do that is to simply say the Attorney General will have jurisdiction to enforce these acts, rather than to make them violations of the UTPA. With respect to the mediation process, last month I participated in a work group of lenders, of consumer representatives, and of representatives of the mediation groups in Washington to make improvements to the Washington law that everybody agreed needed to be made. And I think it's important that we learn from some of the things that they've learned in their, you know, less than a year of experience on the Washington side, what some issues are with mediation. For the mediation process to be effective, the parties have to have information before they go into mediation. They can't just bring information to the mediation and then expect the mediation to happen. So if there will be a mediation requirement, there needs to be a process where the borrower provides information that the lender needs to make a decision on a modification. The lender provides the borrower information about the modification process, approval, denial, whatever the case may be. And all of that happens before the mediation. You can't simply walk into the mediation with this information and say, let's sit down and figure it out, because both parties, the lender and the borrower, need time to evaluate it, and the mediator needs time to evaluate it. So if there's to be a mediation process, it needs to be a more measured process where there's an exchange of information beforehand. There's another problem of lumping junior liens in with first mortgages and treating them the same. If there's a default on the first mortgage, there's no amount of mediation or modification or anything else that can be done on the second loan or third that will fix the problem with the first. And requiring the junior lien holders to go through the same process as the first, when the real issue is whether the first can be fixed or not, is a waste of everyone's time and money. And so I think it would be appropriate to treat junior liens different than senior liens in these bills. And they currently don't do that. So that's another change that could be made. I guess the last thing I'd say is that a lot of the problems that we've heard about with a lot of the large lenders, in my estimation, are problems that have resulted as a part of the complication of the HAMP process, the Home Affordable Modification process. I think it's important that we not enshrine that same process into state law. HAMP has not been a booming success. Some would call it a failure, but I think it's important if we're going to have a process here in state law that we not simply take those same federal issues and enshrine them in state laws, but that we try to do it better and address the problems that have come up there in a more enlightened, a more streamlined, a more effective way, so that we have a solution that works for borrowers and for lenders. And with that, I'll conclude. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just one quick question. So, and I realize we have a lot of people here to talk, but I did want to just ask you about something you said about mediation. So I remember a well-publicized event at the Convention Center, I think it was probably 3 months ago, where one of the five large institutions that was subject to the national litigation, I think it was Bank of America, did a big amount of publicity about coming to the Convention Center, inviting all comers who were basically homeowners in fear of foreclosure because they were bringing somebody empowered to make a mortgage modification then and there in that one day, which seems very similar to the process that's set up in Senate Bill 1552. And today you're testifying that this would be so cumbersome and unworkable, even though 21 other states have programs like this in place. I guess I'm asking why, if it's such a bad idea or would throw our market into chaos, why one of the big banks would have done something very similar.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosenbaum, not only did that bank do it, most of the big banks do it, except for the bank that actually has brick and mortar ongoing everyday modification offices, that's Chase. All the other big banks have done that in Portland. That's a voluntary program that is going, will go, and is inconsistent with and duplicative of what's in 1552. What we are concerned about is in 1552, you're proposing to require, even if that process has gone forward and a solution's been found or it's been determined that no solution is possible in the case, we're proposing that automatically a meeting will be set whether or not the borrower has said they want to come, and a process clicks down for a whole bunch of paperwork to be done. And that's the kind of one-size-fits-all process that we think is expensive and not effective. The banks, the big banks that you're mentioning, Bank of America and others, are anxious to do the kinds of events you've talked about and are going to do more of them. But that's something that doesn't require legislation. That's a process that's ongoing, and it's the result of that is what we're seeing in terms of the data where we're getting better at getting modifications.
And we're going to have to move on. But I would like to get on the record how you're saying that all the credit unions are opposed to this bill.
That is not what I intended to say, and I'm sorry, Senator Shields, if that was the way that it came out. What I would say is that there are improvements that need to be made, and I'm not sure if you're speaking of 1564 or 1562.
Both.
But there are improvements that need to be made in order for them to be effective and to make the situation better rather than worse.
Does the Credit Union Association have a position on these two bills?
The Credit Union Association's position is that improvements would need to be made in order for them to work, and the Credit Union Association is willing to work with the legislators on making those improvements.
Okay, but as of now, you're opposed to the bills.
We would be opposed to them in their credit in their current form.
I'll ask. Thank you. Appreciate your time, gentlemen. Let's move on to the people who have traveled some distance. Let's bring up Elizabeth Peterson and Rick. I can't read your last name, but did you come from? Begins with an L. Did you come from over 100 miles away?
Mount Hood.
Okay.
When?
Would you like to testify now?
I would like to read a statement.
Please come forward.
Mr. Chair, while the witnesses are assembling, I just wanted to point out in Senate Bill 1552 that there is not a requirement in the bill that an unwilling homeowner come to a meeting with the lender. Only those homeowners who respond to a notice of mediation, then the lender is required to come to the meeting. So if a homeowner chooses to ignore this, it's completely a voluntary process.
Thank you. And also, one thing that I've noticed with my local community bank, and I'd like to know if I'm wrong, with Albina Community Bank in my neighborhood, they stopped doing more home loans well before any type of regulatory process came on board. That's my understanding. And I think a lot of the small banks did stop doing home loans before the bubble even burst. I could be wrong on that, and if I am, I'd love to get that information from the Bankers Association. All right, welcome to the committee.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Peterson. I drove up from Klamath Falls, and my experience is with Bank of America. It's not a good experience. I fought tooth and nail for 3 years, nearly 3 years, and couldn't even get a consistent person to speak with me until I filed a complaint with DOJ and Attorney General's office. Funny thing, 2 months later, I had my modification. But that modification has now cost me, I owe more on my mortgage now than I did 6 years ago when I took it out, by about $7,000 in fees and I don't know what all. I missed one payment, and that one payment was only to get somebody to talk to me. They have now told me I'll pay some $94,000 over the next 26 years and then have a balloon payment of $43,000 and change on a $70,000 mortgage. They've destroyed my credit that I have worked so hard to rebuild after horrible medical bills. I'm 100% disabled. It severely affected my health, and our elected officials need to put some teeth on these big lenders. I can't speak for the small community credit unions and banks, but these big lenders have gone too far overboard, mowing down people, and now I can't get another person to talk to me about trying to clean up the credit that was supposed to have been dealt with in this modification. Thank you
for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. My name is Rick Limp. I live in Wemmy, Oregon. I have my uncle's home. He built it as a teenager in the 30s. As part of obtaining my uncle's home, I had to finance the property. When the economy began to deteriorate, I made several late payments. I entered into two different forbearance agreements with the servicer lender over an 18-month period. They defaulted on both contracts. The second default became apparent on August 31st, 2010, when I called to check on the status of the third or fourth loan modification attempt. I was informed that on September 7th, 7 days later, 2010, foreclosure would be completed. I asked when they intended to notify me, and the conversation turned sour. To stop the process, I listed the property for a short sale and bought time to find legal representation and learned that a short sale opened me up to additional liabilities. I am suing EMC Mortgage et al. It's evolved. It's now Chase, etc. I support these Senate bills. I'm not very familiar with them, but what I've read sounds positive. I don't have much sympathy for the banking association or title industry. I share Senator George's concern about small banks. My family were very early capital investors in Clackamas County Bank. I'm proud of that. So are they. I hope the state of Oregon has not jeopardized my rights to due process with the recent settlement. I do have a recommendation for the state of Oregon. I would like to suggest that a couple million dollars from the settlement be used to purchase annual access and administration to Bloomberg's securitized search engine and make this available to victims like ourselves and to our legal representatives. We could very quickly track the movement, ownership of securitized notes and search for evidence of note transfer even before a note was securitized, etc. There are other benefits I am not qualified to explain, but my attorney, John Bowles, and his colleagues are qualified to discuss this with your committee and the Justice Department. I'd be more than happy to make an introduction. Thank you, and I hope I haven't taken too much of your time.
Thank you very much.
If there are any questions, I'll try to answer them.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We really appreciate
just
it.
One more thing. I live in a tiny little 700-square-foot house. It's 82 years old. I've now lost approximately 50% of the value. When I bought my house, I put a third down. I've totally lost that. Bank of America has seen to it that I'm basically a renter in my own home. And please, as our elected officials, do something about these huge lenders who've taken billions of taxpayer dollars and abused the privilege.
Thank you for coming all
Thank
this way
you.
To tell your story. Could I please bring up Tim Collette, Karen McCarthy, and Stella Kaparud?
Good morning, Chair Shields and committee. I hope I can keep this straight. I've been up since 4 o'clock driving over here from Bend. My name's Tim Collette. I'm from Bend, Oregon. I used to be a homeowner. I've been a contractor for almost 40 years. I was done well, and I was this close to being retired. Back in 2008, things started going downhill for the first time in my career. And I went to the bank to try to do the right thing and try to get things worked out. And they said I had to do something that I've never done, and that was to be delinquent on my loan before they would consider it a modification. I said, okay, if that's the way you do things, fine. So I did that, and it led me down the most frustrating path of my life. Over the next several years, I went through 3 trial modifications. Try to get modifications and whatnot. I paid on a forbearance for 13 months, all to no avail. They still took the house. And I made my payments until they refused to take them. So I didn't quit making my payments. I still have my last check that I sent to them, full payment, they sent it back. That's a long story I won't go into. But I had an 810 credit rating before this whole thing started. I'm not a flake. I pay my bills. To this day, I pay my bills. Sometimes I have to rake leaves and shovel snow and vacuum carpets, but I do it. So I wasn't overextended. I had 0 debt when I bought my house. I put a third down, about $125,000, put another 20 into it. That was going to be my last part of my retirement. It's all gone. Construction industry's dried up, and now I barely make it on a monthly basis. They lost paperwork bazillion times, and I've never once been asked to go to a mediation. For everybody said that they would love to do that and do it all the time, I've never heard of anybody being offered that. I'd have been glad to do that, but I kept talking to somebody different every time I talked to somebody from the bank. I've talked to people who are working, who have been through foreclosure, even a couple guys who are with small banks. And they all say the same thing. Everybody's hunkered down. Nobody's doing anything. The guys at the small banks are saying that they have a lot of money they're sitting on because they're afraid of what the big banks and the government's going to do next. It doesn't have anything to do with regulations. They're afraid of what the bigger banks are going to do. This is mostly about the bigger banks. We're good people. We work hard. We pay our bills. When you work with a bank, you normally figure they're going to deal fairly with you, but they don't. As far as I'm concerned, there is no modification process. It starts you down a path that has one conclusion, and that's foreclosure. Even after the bank called me and offered me a modification for the 4th time, I said, okay, I'll do it again. And I went through it. I gave them all the information they asked. They wanted more. I gave it again. They wanted more. I gave it again. I went through that 4 times. Only to be denied again. And that was after I'd been working and proved to them I was making almost the same amount as it was when I got the loan in the first place. They still denied it. A few days later, they foreclosed. The only reason I'm still in my house is because I filed suit in federal court. I figured this they cannot do. And it's not so much about regulations. They don't abide by the laws that are set in place now. They feel like they're above the rules. And if they don't like them, they'll just rewrite them, get together with, you know, top people in federal government, just rewrite them. They don't play by the rules. We're trying to do that. We're hampered by it. The only thing we have left is to come to you people and say, look, we need some sort of regulations for this. There's nothing you can do for me. My home's gone. But I came over here today because I hear of so many people. To this day, 2 weeks ago, a friend of mine, close friend, he's going through the same thing, and the banks are telling him the same thing. Nothing's changed. He has to miss payments before they'll start working with him. He's never done that. So nothing's changed. And if they think that the economy is coming around, it's not that I've seen. And it's because the big banks have got a stranglehold on the economy with what's going on. And we need to change this. We need to move forward to where people aren't going to be losing their houses. The people who are in it are afraid to make any moves. We need to do something to get to move forward.
Thank you, Mr.
And I appreciate it very much if you'd support these bills. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Karen McCarthy. I also traveled over from Central Oregon with Tim this morning. We left at 4 in the morning, or I left at 4 in the morning. So I apologize if I'm a little shaky. It's kind of a little tired, too much coffee. I was here last year about the same time. I actually came here with Tim, and we spoke before the committee. I think it was Senate Bills 826 and 827. I'm here again. I wish I wasn't here. I'm actually a representative for my life partner, Dave Kaiser, who's a farmer. He's self-employed in Madras, Oregon. We have a small farm. It's just under 80 acres. He's diversified. He does many different things. He hauls hay. He has a trucking business. He shoes horses, and he grows a hay crop. He's actually doing fairly well. He has been in the process of trying to get a loan modification from his bank since August of 2009. He was also told to miss payments to show distress so that he could qualify for the HAMP program, which he was accepted into, and promptly after making all his payments, he was denied. And now, currently, we are still in the, what I call the spin cycle, and it spits us out with a new customer service representative with our bank. And I have been dealing with this for him now since October of 2010. He was foreclosed upon in November of 2010. I pushed back, and with the help of some representatives and with some congresspeople, we got the bank to acknowledge the fact that the whole thing was misoriginated. They actually were forced to buy the loan back. We are still now waiting again for this. We've done 11 modifications to date, and we are just still in limbo. It's incredible. I want to address the stress on the homeowner. My partner is aged probably in the last 2 years. He's probably aged 10 to 12 years. People who haven't seen him in a while are actually, they're in disbelief at how much he's aged. It's very severe in our community that I live in. It's a very small community. Lots of low-income people, I mean, they were dumped out of their homes at the beginning of this. And I don't know how we've hung on so long, but you know, what these banks are doing is completely, I mean, it's like beyond the realm of any form of common sense. It makes no sense whatsoever. We're prepared to pay. We want to sit down, and we want to negotiate with this bank and move forward with our lives. We don't want to just lay down and let them walk over the top of us. I do have one thing to say. I was listening very carefully to what Paul Cosgrove from the OBA was saying. He stated that mediation is not as important as a meeting. I would like to respectfully disagree. We did participate in a meeting. It was in December, early December of 2010. It was a complete farce. The lawyer was on a phone conference. He was in Portland. He was with a California law firm that was like a foreclosure mill lawyer for the Bank of America. It was absolutely ridiculous. He is supposed to have a person with authority from the bank on the conference call. That person, he didn't even know her last name, and we couldn't even get it out of her what her last name was and what department she was in during this call. We had it in our attorney's office. And, you know, everyone just threw up their hands. It went nowhere. It lasted maybe 10 minutes. So as far as a mediation versus a meeting, with a mediation, you're going to have an impartial third party who's trained in these things. You know, $100 for the bank to pay is chump change, if they can well afford it. One more thing I wanted to say is that in a mediation, the third party, the impartial third party, they're witness to what's going on. We've been going on for almost 2.5 years, and it's like you go insane on these phone calls getting nowhere with people. It's really a crime.
Thank you for your testimony, and thanks for driving all the way over across the pass. Ms. Cupper.
Good morning, Senator Shields. Thank you for letting me testify today.
I'll try to identify yourself.
Yeah, my name is Stella Copperud, and I am real estate agent in Portland, Oregon, and I own one little investment property, which was the home I grew up in, and I put a mortgage on it to purchase a home that I live in, and it is now the value of the home I believe to be about half of what it was when I owe on it, and it was an adjustable loan, and when it reset, the rent is now cannot cover the payments. I can't make the payments. They're at least $300 above what I can possibly get in rent. So I either had to pay my health insurance or this. Is it too close? Thank you. I hired a real estate agent in the little town of North Plains, and I hired a real estate agent in North Plains because I know that I needed an actual expert, even though I've been a real estate agent for 15 years. And he happened to also have something to do with the city there and knew that they had received stimulus funds to purchase small properties to develop park sites. So he went to the city of North Plains, and they made an offer of $120,000 to purchase this property, which is right across the street from the city hall and the fire department and everything, so it's a perfect place for a park. The only reason they offered $120,000 is because of what they're going to use it for. The house itself devalues the property, actually. Long story, because of zoning changes and changes to the property itself. I believe that the property is worth about $100,000. And so in pursuing this short sale, they get what the bank calls a broker price opinion. That came in at $140,000, which I and my realtor know, because we are on the ground in that particular community, is impossible. The investor will not talk to either my realtor or myself. My realtor communicates with the investor via email, and the investor is Aurora Bank, and I don't know where they are, Colorado, I think. They're looking on paper at information that isn't good for them. My solution of a short sale would keep me out of foreclosure, would get them $120,000 for the property. Their solution of not talking to me and not listening to me, in my professional opinion, is going to end up losing them money as well, because they're never going to get what they think on paper it looks like, because they won't talk directly to us and let us, both of us being real estate agents who have some knowledge of this, because they won't talk directly to us, they are proceeding with the foreclosure while we're scrambling like crazy to try to figure out how to make them understand the real value of the property, and that I'm going to lose and they're going to lose. If I were to proceed with this short sale, both of my parents were very active in this community. I want this short sale to go through because I believe that this could be a little city park named after my parents. And that's the resolution I would like. And the irony is, I have one person that I'm supposedly able to talk to at GMAC, who is the servicer. As far as I can tell, my relationship manager's job is to just let me yell at her, because she can't do anything. She has no authority to do anything. And the person with the real authority won't communicate with anybody involved. So it's going to hurt me a lot, and the irony is it's going to hurt them too.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Let's bring up Janet Bird, Sharon Nassett, Yolanda Lopez. And as we move forward, I really want to try to make sure we have enough time to get everybody who came to testify. So if there's anything you can do to keep your comments concise, that'll make sure everybody has a chance.
Go ahead. Good morning, Senator Shields, members of the committee. My name is Janet Byrd. I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Housing Alliance. And I did submit written testimony, so I'll be brief. The Housing Alliance is a coalition of organizations across the state that's concerned with the availability of affordable housing for folks with low and modest incomes. We're very concerned about the problems that foreclosures have caused in Oregon communities, and we thank you for taking the time to hear these bills. I did submit testimony on three bills, 1552, 1564, and 1576. We very much urge you to take action in February on these bills. We're very supportive of the concepts. On the second page of my testimony, I just listed some principles that we would like to see embodied, which we think that you've done a good job of capturing in the bills that you're hearing. I was doing a little bit of work trying to think about how to talk about the breadth of this problem and looking at the numbers. 1 in 9 Oregon homeowners with a mortgage have either been foreclosed on or in default. It's a huge crisis. I looked up disasters in Oregon, and it's hard to find anything, fires, tsunamis, anything that equals this. So I think we have to act. It is a complicated issue. You heard a lot of testimony from the industry about how complicated the regulations are. I think it's time to shift the burden a little bit in favor of homeowners, make sure that homeowners have access to information, have access to people who can answer their questions and move things forward without putting them onto a dual track or other things that that lead to bad outcomes. So thank you very much again, and very much support and urge your passage of these bills. I just would add that we're hopeful also that you'll be able to hear the issue related to loan servicer regulation if that comes over to you from the House. We're also interested in seeing that move forward this session. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for having the hearing. For the record, my name is Sharon Nassett. I actually have been involved in this process personally as well as professionally. I have been foreclosed on twice without missing any payments to begin with, and was left in foreclosure for over 18 months, and it was printed every day in the Daily Journal of Commerce. I'm also a real estate broker and have been for 16 years, which meant I got to see that all the time, come up on the sheets, and have people come to my personal home. I dealt with foreclosures and short sales, and as the people here are saying, the banks have no desire, and there is nothing in it for them to cooperate. The modifications have not worked. What I would recommend, instead of doing any bills, is to immediately stop what is going on and know that the accident has occurred, and immediately start with a refinance loan that the only qualification is that a person is on title at 3% and have it amortized for a longer period of time, such as 40 to 50 years. By resetting it for everybody instead of picking who wins and choose who wins and loses, you have the ability to reset the entire housing market, stop it from falling, and have the loan itself, as it's being described in its refinancing, take care of the issues you want, such as having 100% guarantee to smaller banks and less of a guarantee to larger banks, so people can naturally pull away from the larger banks, allow people to mark off if they want to be sold into the large bond market or if they want to be in a semi-portfolioed type of loan, and a list of other things that I can bring to you. But what this would do is stop it, give us a paper trail, and restart it. The banks themselves who have been the problem are not the ones to fix it, and analyzing it, why everybody is dying, isn't going to help us either. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Ms. Lopez, welcome to the committee.
Thank you and good morning, Chair Shields and Vice Chair George and members of the committee. My name is Yolanda Lopez. I am a Washington County recording clerk. I am currently living in Hillsborough. At one time, I was a homeowner of two properties, one property where my disabled parents are living, will be foreclosed a couple of weeks from today, and my home has been wrongfully foreclosed, and while I was negotiating with U.S. Bank for a loan modification for the last 3 years. I am here today to testify that I'm a victim of mortgage fraud and to tell you how I'm trapped in this web. On December 15, 2011, my home where I'm living now was wrongfully foreclosed and by the servicer, U.S. Bank Home Mortgage, acting in his own name, but on behalf of the investor, Freddie Mac. My home was sold on December 15 by FEI LLC. The person who conducted the foreclosure sale identified himself as an employee of FEI LLC. FEI LLC is not an entity licensed to do business in either Oregon or Washington. On its website, they claim to be headquartered in Bellevue, Washington. When my husband and I bought this first home together in 2007, we believe that we have... I'm sorry.
Okay, take your time.
Sorry, it's so hard for me.
That's all right. Would you like to take a little bit of time and we can bring up some others and you can come back?
It's all right. I will try to finish. We believe that we have achieved the American dream. We were able to put $32,000 down payment on our home. My husband had a stable job in the construction industry. But at the end of 2007, my husband got laid off. So it took a few months for my husband to start collecting unemployment benefits. Unemployment was something new for my husband. I have worked for Washington County for over 14 years, for more than 3 years. I struggled to make my mortgage payments and my income alone, but we did not default. In 2009, when I found out about HAMP, the federal loan modification program to prevent foreclosure, I called U.S. Bank to request a loan modification to see if we qualify. U.S. Bank sent me an approval letter in March of 2009. However, in May 2010, a year later, U.S. Bank sent me a letter that the investor denied the loan modification. Later on, I was told that the application was rejected because we were current on our mortgage payments. This back and forth went on for more than 1 year, and U.S. Bank sent me letters acknowledging that they will help me to save my home. During the last 3 years, I never lost contact with the U.S. Bank. I called them by phone. I faxed hardship letters and proof of my income. I never stopped asking for help to U.S. Bank, the servicer of the loan, to save my home from being foreclosed. I met with the U.S. Bank representative in person when I received a letter and an email from U.S. Bank of a foreclosure prevention event at the Oregon Convention Center in December. I met in person with a collection specialist who uploaded one application packet. He told me that the foreclosure will be stopped while the loan modification was put together. He also said that it will take about 30 days for them to send the paperwork for me to sign. And while I sat there, he typed an email to the foreclosure department instructing them to cancel the sale. He promised me I will get a step loan modification, one that will escalate the lack and a 4%. Despite the promises, U.S. Bank foreclosed on my home. Because of the wrongful actions of U.S. Bank, we were denied the opportunity to avoid the foreclosure sale. Whether by pursuing an alternative to foreclosure or taking legal action to stop the foreclosure. I trust my lender. I will never have imagined that a free country that preaches
Max will have mortgage fraud. Soon we will find out. For us, the American dream is a myth. After an extensive search for attorneys, I found one. Her fees are $250 per hour. I'm afraid I will not be able to afford her and may be forced to walk away from my property. I hope my story has shown to you how complicated, contradictory Oregon's current foreclosure process is. Oregon needs to give us the chance to save our American dream. I can tell you from personal experience that had the laws you're considering today been in place, I truly believe I will have had a much different story today. You can help me write, you can help me write the ending of my story and those of so many other Oregonians by passing Senate Bill 1552 and Senate Bill 1564. Thank you. And I apologize.
Thank you very much for giving that heartfelt testimony. And we appreciate you bringing this story forward. I know it's very difficult for you to do.
It's very difficult, sorry.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. Please bring up Ginny Reel, Amy Cleary, and Sybil Hebb.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, if you'd indulge me, I was looking at the bottom of Mrs. Lopez's written testimony, and in her discussion there, this is one of the events that Senator Rosenbaum brought up, in which their banks were supposed to set up a process in which, you know, to help someone, and in the end, it destroyed someone.
From the committee.
Good morning, committee. Chair Shields, thank you for listening to us this morning as we go through these testimonies. My name is Amy Cleary. I live in Lake Oswego, Oregon. I'm employed by Clackamas County. I'm the program coordinator for the Community Dispute Resolution Center there. And I'm also here with Charlie Eichard, who is the chair, the president of Neighbor to Neighbor, which is a nonprofit organization in Salem that provides community mediation services in that community within the county. There are 17 community mediation programs around the state of Oregon that provide services to 25 counties. And we've gathered quarterly and talk about opportunities to provide services to residents of the state of Oregon. We have traditionally provided mediation services to communities in terms of neighbor-to-neighbor issues. We've also had experience with small claims issues. We sometimes deal with larger community disputes as well. And we're here today to support Senate Bill 1552, which would provide mediation services in foreclosure situations. We believe that community mediation has been a good way for people to access services when maybe other options are not available to them. I do realize that this is a complicated situation with foreclosure processes. We believe that we would be able to consider looking at the process of going through responding to the past speaker. We've had the ability to do rulemaking in the past for other issues. We believe that if we were going through rulemaking, we'd be able to work out a lot of the details about how mediation would be applied in this particular context. We do like the idea that 1552 includes some money that would be available to help fund this, because it would be a large process that would need to be put in place. But because there are so many community mediators and private practitioners around the state of Oregon that are interested in this area, and we know that we could provide training and get the processes in place to make it work, that there's a lot of potential here. So we just want you to know that as mediators in the state of Oregon, I think you'd have a lot of interest and the ability to put something in place quickly. So thank you for listening.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Ms. Rail?
Good morning. My name's Jenny Real. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to come today from Chair Shields and Vice Chair George. To start with, I lived in my home for 24 years on Marietta Street, Southeast. I'm here today to tell you why I don't live there anymore. To start with, my husband Patrick has many major medical problems. He's on oxygen full time. He has congestive heart failure. He has a brain injury from an aneurysm and a stroke. It has left him with many problems. In fact, he spent all last week in the hospital from Sunday to Friday afternoon. I'm his caregiver, and it's a 24-hour-a-day job. Due to the unexpected medical bills, I began trying to modify my mortgage with Chase Bank at the end of 2010. In February of 2011, I talked with a gentleman from Chase to try and restructure the $54,000 left owed on our mortgage. I had applied for a loan modification and did everything the bank and its representatives told me to do. I continued to stay in contact with Chase and was always told things were going well with my modification application. But then Chase lost the modification paperwork. I stayed in contact and filed another set of paperwork. Ironically, the date was April Fool's Day. And let me tell you, that sure seemed fitting. This time, they said it was not complete. Even though I had a FedEx receipt from the entire document, I asked what was missing, and they couldn't tell me. This time, they discarded the whole file. When I learned the second application hadn't gone through for some mysterious reason, Chase couldn't explain it to me. I filed again in July. I tried to fax things for 4 days. I couldn't get through. I was told when I called that they had a fax problem. When I did get it faxed, it took them 2 days to confirm they received it. So I was told. I have a complete set of this paperwork. I was reassured everything was there and complete, that everything was okay, not to worry. I called on Monday, July 25th, and was told there was nothing I could do to reinstate the loan. I was told again that the paperwork was there, but it was too late. On July 26, 2011, there was a knock on the door and a paper saying, "We have 10 days to move." Our home had been sold. I called Chase, and they told me I should have reinstated the loan the day before, even though they told me the opposite the day before. I have been lied to constantly by Chase customer service. They tell you everything is going fine and not to worry. They would call, but would not put anything in writing. Then they take your home. I was never served any paperwork on the property. My husband lived at for 24 years. Chase chose to communicate by phone. I don't have much from them in writing. I was never even sent a notice of default. We ended up being forced out of our home since the new buyers were on their way. With my husband's disabilities, he became very stressed. The purchaser tried coming into the house and making demands on the last day. It was truly a nightmare. It was too much for my husband. He went into heart failure with the stress and ended up in the hospital. I fell in my rush trying to get all of our belongings out of our home. I also ended up in the hospital. The stress that this situation has caused is unthinkable. This is about so much more than just the roof over our heads. After we lost our house, we were homeless for a time and finally went to live with our children. It's hard for me to tell you this. I'm a private person, but I need you to know that this is happening to good people who played by the rules, like Patrick and me. I really wish that there had been some laws in place to stop this from happening to us. My thinking is better late than never. Please pass these laws so other people don't go through what happened to us. Give people a chance to at least see if they can find another solution. My husband and I didn't buy a home we couldn't afford, and we would couldn't have kept our home. If we could have kept our home, if only our bank would have sat down with us and said, yes, we're willing to make some small changes to your mortgage so that you can pay off the $54,000. This is an issue that really affecting everybody, and we need your help to fix it. You have the power to give homeowners a fighting chance. Please use it to pass Senate Bill 1552 and Senate Bill 1564. Thank you.
Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, members of the committee, my name is Sybil Hebb. I'm with the Oregon Law Center here today to provide support for Senate Bills 1552 and Senate Bill 1564. We very much appreciate the work of the chair and the members of the committee in bringing these issues forward and considering them. The Oregon Law Center's mission, as you know, is to achieve access to justice for low-income people. And this right now, this issue, the access to fair due process within the foreclosure process, is one of the biggest issues for our offices across the state. It didn't used to be that low-income people qualifying for legal assistance from legal aid were homeowners. It was the rare case. That's no longer the case because of the economic crisis and because of the foreclosure crisis. So more and more of our clients are homeowners struggling as a result of this crisis. And often what we find is that homeowners are struggling on the verge of homelessness as a result of the outcome of a foreclosure process. We don't ask today, in asking for your support of these bills, to assure any particular specific outcome in any particular case. What we ask is for your help, and we believe that these bills will provide that help in providing a fair and reliable process for people as they go through foreclosure when they're faced with that event. What we hope is to avoid foreclosures where they're unnecessary, where they are avoidable, but also importantly, just as importantly, we hope to identify in a fair and effective manner when that's not going to be the case. If foreclosure is inevitable, homeowners benefit from knowing that ahead of time and from understanding that and having a reliable amount of time within which to plan for that process. And what we find over and over again is echoes of the tragic stories that you've heard today in which that hasn't been the case. And families are thrown into even greater crisis than they would have been by the thought of losing their homes because of the way in which that process has been handled. So I'll speak today most specifically about Senate Bill 1564, because I think most of the testimony before has been about the mediation bill. I want to make it very clear that we're very supportive of Senate Bill 1552, the mediation bill, and I'll just speak generally about that before really trying to hit the key points on the dual track bill. With respect to mediation, I think there are just a couple of questions that bear elaboration after previous testimony. First of all, there is no requirement that a borrower who is unwilling to participate in that process participate. So there's a very good mechanism that Oregon has come up with that this bill proposes that avoids some of the problems that have happened in other states, because you're only providing mediation and a sit-down where the borrower wants that and notifies and acknowledges in writing and or by phone that that's the case. So we believe that the bill is very well targeted in that respect. The other thing is that the presence of a third-party neutral person to oversee that lends fairness, lends process, and makes it more a more reliable process than is a simple meeting where there is not a third-party neutral person supervising. So the mediation process proposed by the bill is far better than our informal meetings set up by banks throughout, as has happened previously. The other point that I would just want to make is that the process of state-provided mediation programs is something that's been endorsed by the National Center for State Courts as recently as the end of 2011. They've looked at these processes in other states. They believe that it's an effective way of addressing the crisis and are supportive and urging support for states to consider and further implement that. So those are the points I would just make with respect to the mediation proposals. With respect to Senate Bill 1564, there are a couple of points that have been brought up previously around whether or not it's important to have this additional notice. What the bill does is require that the lenders, the trustees engaged in negotiations with a borrower, make sure to let the borrower know at least 30 days before the sale date that either that conversation is closed, there is no further negotiation, or that the borrower is out of compliance with something that the parties have agreed to. And those two principles seem to me to be short, simple, very common sense, and non-burdensome means for the banks to provide fairness and reliability in the process to the borrowers. And if that process is not complied with, the bill provides a sanction. And the sanction is something that was also objected to previously. And we think that given how many errors in process happen currently, there needs to be some form of enforcement, both at the Attorney General level and for private parties, to make sure that these simple and clear requirements are complied with. So the enforcement provision, we believe, has good public policy purpose. The only other two points I would hit very quickly are that there currently is a provision in the law that allows a lender or a trustee to postpone a foreclosure sale date at up to 180 days, and that's a lot of time. The sale date is a trigger point, a key point that's important for the borrowers in terms of assessing and analyzing what rights they have with respect to the property and with respect to the process. If that sale date is postponed, that has a huge impact on borrowers. Right now, there's no requirement that the borrower get notice of that postponed sale date, and that just seems like a blatant process problem. So we'd like to have that fix made. There's also a small fix proposed related to the definition of residential trust deed, and that is something that's a technical fix. Right now, what we have is borrowers who are protected from deficiency judgments if they are being foreclosed on their principal residence, and that definition is tied to the time of the starting of the action. What we have now is many borrowers are in foreclosure because of unemployment. They may be forced to move in with family members. They may be forced to move to other communities if they lose their jobs and find one somewhere else. We don't want to discourage that choice for the borrower. It may be the safest thing for their family, and it's a loophole that is right now getting causing more borrowers to be open to deficiency judgments if a lender stops the current process and then refiles after the borrower has moved so that they no longer qualify. And we think that's not in good public policy, and it's not the intent of the original statute. So those are the three technical points I wanted to make, and I really appreciate, again, all of your attention, and we'd be happy to work further.
Thank you, Sybil. We appreciate you putting those comments on the record. Colleagues, let me tell you what my intention is. I do want to put on the record that these bills have been worked on in one form or another for a very long time. In fact, a lot of the current bills are based on previous bills that either passed or were sunsetting. It is my intention to move these two bills, and so for those of you who think that these bills still need some tweaking, I would encourage you to work with us over the next week or work over on the House side if there's some refinement, but we can't wait and postpone this for another round till the next legislative session. I do appreciate all the testimony that's going on. We do want to get this policy right, and I think we're on the right track. So I think my intention also is to move the amendment in the next hearing. I'd like to put on the record, I'll be rolling these over to the next meeting, these two bills. And
Mr. Chair, just a process question. So I believe we are only now in a public hearing on these mm-hmm. two bills. If your intention is also to hold a work session on these at the next hearing, you could either open a work session now and roll it over, or I think we have plenty of time still to do the 24-hour notice requirement and post the bills for work session on at our next hearing.
Thank you very much. Your impression as well, Dan.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is we have posted it for a work session today, possible work session, so we need not open the work session to carry over as long as it was posted for a work session.
All right. Good. Well, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1552 and Senate Bills 1564. Colleagues, if you could hang in there for just a couple more minutes, I do want to also open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1589. The parties have been meeting out in the hall to suggest where we should go from here on this. So if I could please bring up Clyde Psyche, Robert Bruce, and Mark Landauer. Tell us where we stand.
Just
Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Deputy for Central Services for ODOT. Senator Shields, we appreciate your and Mary Alicia and Jan's efforts.
Excuse me for a second. Could you all please take your private conversations out into the hall? We still have another hearing going on. Could you please take your private conversations out in the hall? Thank you. Clyde, welcome.
Thank you, Senator Shields. And again, appreciate your efforts and Jan and Mary Alicia's efforts to try to get us to some kind of closure around this issue. For ODOT's position, we've worked very closely with your staff and the proponents and other people. And as it stands right now, we are able to live with the bill and implement the bill and in its current form. And so I guess that's kind of where we stand right now. And we have, I think, primarily the majority of price agreements around these services in the state. So,
Mark. Good morning, Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon and the Oregon Public Courts Association today. Just to cut to the chase, I know we have 2 minutes left, and want to just get it on the record. We have some concerns with the bill. We've made significant progress since last session with Senate Bill 667, I believe, and the language as it stands now is certainly significantly better. However, we still have some concerns on the interplay between this proposal and the recently adopted qualification-based selection bill, which you passed last session and only became operative at the beginning of this year. There are small public contracting agencies throughout the state who are very unfamiliar with this new requirement and are only beginning to learn this new process. We still have some questions on the interplay between this proposal and the recently adopted requirements under QBS. We would like to thank the senator, the committee administrator, and staff for the hard work that has gone into this. We remain committed to continuing to work on this, and we hope that we can stand shoulder to shoulder in 2013 and say we're ready to do this. But at this point, we still have some concerns with this. I don't think we're that far away, but we would ask that you hold off on any action on this bill at this time until we have those concerns addressed. And I thank you very much.
Thanks. Robert.
Good morning, members of the committee, Chair Shields, Vice Chair George. I'm with Clyde. I'm kind of prepared.
Could you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Rob Bruce, Sandy River Construction Services. I'm kind of siding with Clyde. I think we're prepared to move ahead. Mr. Landauer's, I don't understand. I don't see where he has much of a validity in what he's saying. He stated in his letter a number of things. But I just can't make him hold water, kind of no matter how hard I try. Just a couple of notes that I had here, and I know we are short on time, so I'll cut it short. I think the bill needs to be passed. This economy and the new emerging one doesn't allow room for waste. We as small businesses can't afford to fill out frivolous RFPs that lead us nowhere. Government contracting agencies shouldn't have room for issuing these types either. I didn't know that they had $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 laying around to just do nothing absolutely with. You're going to hear more opposition as the week goes on, that this bill will increase administrative costs. Maybe if these same agencies didn't spend tens of thousands of dollars issuing these types, that no work come from, then we wouldn't be having these conversations in the first place.
Robert, I'm going to have to, we've got to be on the floor in just a minute, but I really just want to get a sense of where the parties were. It sounds like there are a number of parties who are still uncomfortable. So I'm going to roll this bill over as well. Oh, 11 o'clock floor session. Oh, take your time.
But some of us do have to leave.
Yeah, well.
I'm sorry.
but I could stay till 11. So. thank you for that. But I think I understand your point. You two feel fine with the bill. There are a number of parties, you're speaking for the special districts, the Port Association, anyone else who you feel is opposed to the bill at this point?
Well, Chair Shields, again, Mark Landauer, I am only authorized to speak for the special districts and the ports. I know that the cities, counties, the school boards have also been involved in these conversations and were unable to be here today, but I know that they have expressed some concerns in the conversations that we've had with the parties as well.
Okay. All right. Senator Boquist.
Just for the administrator, good question. This is a continuation of the bill we heard multiple times during the regular session, isn't it?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think what we'll do is we'll roll this over till Wednesday as well. It sounds like some decisions need to be made about how to proceed, and I'll talk to the proponents and see what their thoughts are. And that being said, I really appreciate you all sticking in there with me as long as you have, and ODOT particularly for being putting in hours and hours of work, and the other parties as well. At the end of the day, what we want is to make sure that small business has a fair shot at these, and if we don't proceed with the bill this session, I think we'll probably end up having a number of hearings over the course of the interim, also during this session, to find out who's exactly getting this contract, these contracts, and what we can do to make sure that small business has a fair shot. So with that being said, I will close the
public hearing
on
1589,
and we are ready to adjourn, right, with rolling these over?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And this meeting is adjourned.